Hello everybody, I'm Jacob De Toni and this is the FDI podcast. FDI magazine was in Cannes a few weeks back to attend MIPIM, one of the world's largest events for property and real estate development, and always a great place to get a gauge of the current sentiment among investors and local authorities. I was there at MIPIM with Courtney Finger, editor-in-chief of FDI magazine, and Sebastian Sciadi, our global markets reporter, who both joined me today in our studio in London. Courtney, you have been covering MIPIM for many years now. So what did catch your attention this year?
Yes, well, I'm possibly dating myself, but this was my 14th MIPIM. Wow. And I always find that it's an interesting barometer of the economic mood in the moment in Europe, but also in the world. And attendance numbers at MIPIM are also indicative of whether we're in a kind of bull or bear phase. Right. And according to the organizers of the conference, this was the second largest attended conference for MIPIM ever, with 26,000 people. And apart from the numbers, I did find a feeling of buoyancy, maybe cautious optimism. There's a lot of uncertainty in the world, but people seem to be in a fairly optimistic mood, not quite to the levels that we saw in MIPIMs of past, right before the financial crisis. So the MIPIMs of 2007, for example, where there was a lot of exuberance in the market, it's not quite at that level, but I'm finding given the backdrop of uncertainty and geopolitical turmoil and that we're facing in the world, that people seemed fairly optimistic and calm.
And they are multiplying efforts to reach out and to convey investors the message that there are opportunities on the ground for investors and for developers.
Absolutely. Have to be even more proactive right now.
Right. Sebastian, on the other hand, this was your first time at MIPIM. So what have been your main takeaways from the event?
Similarly, I was a little surprised at the optimism. Maybe being a little too focused on political events myself, I thought people would be in a more sullen mood. But this was a real estate conference, and real estate did really well last year. And the big boys such as Cushman & Wakefield and CBRE came out with reports at the conference that indicated, well, not just indicated, that concluded that last year was an incredible year for investment into real estate. And FDI Markets also, our own data confirmed this. So we saw that 2017 saw the highest amount of FDI, greenfield FDI, into real estate since 2008. That's a huge thing. So I think this is why people are optimistic. And it's coming off a global sort of upswing in the economy, not just in real estate.
One interesting part for me was definitely there was a very strong British representation at the event, with local authorities like London and West Midlands, Manchester or Liverpool, all taking the best places, the most visible places around the venue. Obviously, it felt like nobody was really mentioning the Brexit word, but definitely everybody was trying to convey a message of openness. For example, London, the London Pavilion had this slogan, London is open, trying in a way to break through this kind of idea that Brexit is going to isolate the country. So did you guys buy into these messages of openness, or you think that Brexit still makes local destination, investment destination around the UK is still a bit of a gamble at the moment?
Well, I do think it's obviously coming back to the word uncertain again. It's hard for companies to speculate on what the scenario will be in a few years with regard to access to the European market for financial services, but as well as exports and other sectors. So I do think there's a big question mark hanging over the UK at the moment. But as you say, in a time like this, it's when investment promotion agencies really can show their worth and earn their keep, as it were. And they do need to push back against the idea that the UK is closing itself off. I mean, there's a whole separate debate over whether that is what the Brexit vote was about. Sure. And whether that's what the country wants, but it's in general not the best look. So I do think it falls to the municipalities and the investment agencies at the city and regional level to counteract the national uncertainties as best they can.
I found that it really varied from mayor to mayor, and maybe from region to region. So for example, the mayor of West of England, Tim Bowles, he was quite optimistic. He said, well, look, it's an opportunity, Brexit is an opportunity. Whereas the mayor of, rather the city council leader of Nottingham and Manchester, they voiced fears. In fact, Nottingham's city leader called it a national catastrophe. At first, he vacillated. He didn't want to say it. It was interesting. He said, Nottingham voted marginally in favour of Brexit. There was an awkward pause, and then he said, personally, I think it's a national catastrophe. And then he railed on for about 2 minutes on it. Sir Richard Lees, the council leader for Manchester, he said, Brexit is a threat. I'm waiting to see any opportunities coming from it. So the very opposite of what Tim Bowles, Mayor of West of England, said. So I think maybe that reflects a difference, a regional sort of
perspective,
as well as just personal ones. People are still very sore about it, especially at least in the Midlands and the North, if you want to call Manchester.
And
it's
also calls for European destinations who are also being more proactive, who think that they can benefit UK's losses, potentially their gain. So I've been hearing a lot, obviously, while not wanting to stir things up and be seen to benefit from the UK's current problems, obviously German locations, Irish, who are arguably always the best investment promoters in the world, as well as French locations, are really feeling there's a moment they can capitalize on right now.
And Valérie Pécresse, who's the president of the Paris region, she specifically said that the reason FDI into Paris hit a record high in 2017 was in part thanks to Brexit. And as you said, the German mayors were, I think, of all the mayors I spoke to, the Germans, I went on a speed date, as they called it, with seven German mayors. They all said, look, we're going to take this opportunity. We're going to make the most of this, and we're coming over there to advertise our opportunities to take business from you.
Everybody wants a piece of their Brexit cake, in a way.
Absolutely, but they were the most sort of cut and dry about how they were going to take our business. Yeah. And fair enough.
Political uncertainty, well, far beyond Brexit, in a way, and this goes far beyond Brexit. And this was also the feeling that we got from MIPIM. There were many different countries that are experiencing domestic or like international geopolitical turbulences. For example, Turkey definitely had a very strong presence at the event. And it's always interesting to get the perspective of local authorities rather than national authorities in these countries, because as it happens in the UK, they can have like a different angle of national development. And one very interesting meeting I had was with Mehmet Kalyonsu. He's a board member of Kalyon, which is one of the biggest Turkish construction company. And he's got a very strong local footprint in a city called Gaziantep, which is at the border with Syria, and experienced a huge influx of refugees in the past years. And this is, well, actually 500,000 Syrian refugees kind of crossed the border and sought shelter in the city, which is a massive amount of people for a mid-sized city in Turkey. And this is what he told me. This is the perspective that he gave me on the Syrian refugee crisis.
The Turkish economy grew so rapidly that local workforce was not enough for our economic growth. So Syrian people came to Turkey. That was a problem for industrial investors to find workers. So it solved the employment problem for us. It has advantages and disadvantages. This is one of the advantages. Of course, economically, Turkey has used 30 billion euro of budget for the Syrian people since the start of the civil war. So economically, it is a burden. But I think the return in long time, it will be good.
And another country that always appears to be in a sort of the eye of the storm is Russia. And in Kandahar was a representation from the government of the city of Moscow. And I spoke to Sergei Chermin, the head of economic and international relations of the government of Moscow, about sanctions and how sanctions have affected over the years the local economy and the national economy. And he was also kind of pretty defiant in his answer. This is what he told me.
If you look at what sanctions are about, you'll find that on the first stage, it was a little bit of shock. And within a year or two, everybody get used to this. Nowadays, I cannot say, please come to Moscow and you'll see that the city is not affected at all. Unfortunately, because of sanctions, some Western countries are losing great opportunities for international trade and cooperation. But even the last year showed that, for example, with Moscow, European Union, the main, let's say, investors and suppliers are Germany, Italy, France. They have the growth of international trade with Russia. In some cases, it's 18%. With Italy, it's nearly 30%. And that shows that business adopted itself, and there is a positive appreciation of the potential of not only Moscow, but also Russian Federation.
So in both cases, in a way, kind of perceptions on the ground probably are different from perception that we get from the outside. Local authorities accept that it's not business as usual, but still they seem to be suggesting that still it's business.
Well, I mean, business tends to always find a way to go on, even if it's a little bit costlier, a bit more difficult. So that's the reality. I think there's also the issue, especially on the political side. You can't very well come out to a place to promote investment and say that it's all exceptionally difficult and you're suffering and having a bad time. So you have to put a bit of a spin on it. While, again, at the same time, it is true that investment, trade and business, they do go on one way or the other, even against a difficult backdrop or barrier.
And as far as I understand, Sebastian, you also had an interesting encounter with a political analyst in MIPIM, correct?
Yes, I spoke to Charles Hecker, who's a senior partner at Control Risks, the leading political consultancy. And here's what he told me.
Control Risks doesn't necessarily see any global geopolitical threat to the growth cycle at the moment. We think that the most important geopolitical risks right now are regional in nature, and that actually these regional conflicts don't have the potential to disrupt global economic growth. I'll probably very quickly after that add a couple of buts, but some of the places that we're focusing on naturally include the Korean Peninsula and the Middle East and trade and protectionism and populism, which segues into the sort of but behind all of this. We don't believe, it's not our view, that a global trade war is looming. That said, particularly given some recent decisions coming out of Washington, we believe that there is room for isolated sector-specific and country-specific trade disputes that will probably stay on the level of skirmish rather than global trade war, which is a term that you hear bandied about quite frequently. And so, the primary threats to foreign investment is this increasing atmosphere of protectionism and economic nationalism that is accompanying this wave of populism, particularly as applies to Europe.
In other words, I believe he reiterated what Courtney summarized, which is that despite terms like global trade war being bandied about, despite a lot of media attention, this won't turn into a global catastrophe. Trade will go on, especially in other sectors. Investment will go on in other sectors. I think the last thing that interested me that was that he said he believes that globalization has reached the limits of its elasticity. I thought that was interesting that he was very strong on that point. So I don't know what that means for the future, but it's interesting to hear that a leading firm like that say.
The latest episode of The Next Five podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next Five wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
The latest episode of The Next Five podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of The Next Five wherever you get your podcasts.
So meaning that he's expecting more protectionism moving forward, or anyway, this kind of liberal push has kind of exhausted, come to an end for him.
I think that's what he's implying. But at the same time, he's saying he doesn't. There's no global threat to economic growth. So I'm not. It was a bit of a contradiction. He implied that things would be getting worse, but then he said it wouldn't.
Well, actually, there are so many things happening also beyond trade and political uncertainties. And actually, I mean, being one of a few other mega trends were discussed extensively. For example, urbanization and trends for mega cities that has been going on for a while now, but also definitely automation and regeneration of urban spaces. And with regard to the former, to automation, it was interesting what Andy Street, who is the first ever elected mayor of the West Midlands, told me. The West Midlands has always been a hub for traditional manufacturing in the country, in the UK, for many years. Then they were lagging behind during the times of the services economy in the past 20, 30 years. But now they're staging a comeback with betting big on advanced manufacturing with players like Jaguar Land Rover investing big in the area. And this is what he told us.
Each job in manufacturing creates much more output than an average job in the economy, and that's a complete sea change from where manufacturing was 20, 30 years ago. So it's right cutting edge. It is just the type of job that we want, that high value, high tech job.
What's going to happen to all the people that haven't got the skills to do those jobs?
A, they will develop the skills, but B, more importantly, there are lots of other sectors of the economy that sort of are in support of those areas, and that's always been the case. In any time in history, there have been the cutting-edge jobs and then there have been the mass jobs. And what's brilliant is manufacturing in the West Midlands is now back at the cutting edge.
So, yeah, in a way, it gives us the positive perspective on automation, and also the West Midlands, they are about to get the high-speed train delivered in a few years. However, I believe that the transition toward advanced manufacturing will be more painful than he believes, most of all for these people that haven't got the skills to adjust to the new level of knowledge and capacity that is required in this advanced manufacturing world. What do you guys think of this? How can this kind of affect local development and investment promotion at the local level?
Well, it is a disruption, as you say, and it's sometimes a painful one, but it all hinges on the skills and the places that will survive best the shift to automation are those who've been out on front and were already anticipating the kind of skills that companies would need and manufacturers would need. And I think in a lot of probably in more places in the world than not, the skills aren't there yet to match. So you can save jobs through automation. They're just different types of jobs and they require different types of skills. In a lot of places in the world, they've not yet been out enough in front of this issue in order to train their workers to be able to have the skills that automation demands. And that's what's going to be necessary in anywhere in the world, whether developed or undeveloped economy, in order to survive and even thrive during the age of automation.
Seb, you want to have a final line on this? You also had a couple of meetings on automation there, right?
So Charles Hecker from Control Risk, he was saying that really we need to be focusing on retraining and re-education. So we need to preempt this trend. And although more jobs are being lost to automation than overseas competitors or multilateral trade agreements, despite all the fear surrounding those things, despite the fact that automation is taking so many jobs, he doesn't think it's a global threat. Once again, being rather optimistic, and he's putting all the emphasis on training and re-education.
Well, this is all for now from EPIM 2018. Thank you both for being here on the show today. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. You can find all our podcasts on fdiintelligence.com/podcast or on Acast and iTunes. Stay tuned. Thanks.
Thanks.